Good to see all of you this morning. Appreciate your interest in our study of history and geography of the Bible. It's been a journey, as one series of lesson books call themselves, the journey through the Bible, and that's basically what we're doing in this history and geography study. I'm very much encouraged by your continued interest and participation. We're almost to the end of this study. We're discussing where we're going to go after this, but for now, if you would, turn in your Bibles to Acts chapter 25. Acts chapter 25. We're going to be talking a bit about Festus in our study this morning, and time permitting, King Agrippa in Acts chapter 26, the shipwreck as it is discussed in the remaining chapters of the book of Acts, as Paul makes his appeal and makes his way to Rome to appear before the Roman Emperor Caesar. In Acts chapter 25, we're following about the interviews of the Apostle Paul, or the defense, rather, of the Apostle Paul before these Roman authorities. We know, and I'd like for you to remember the order of the chapters, and perhaps, James, you could tell us about that, beginning with Paul's arrest in Acts chapter 21. We have something pretty new introduced in each chapter up to this point. Can you help us with that?
And that's the two names that I always confuse, Felix and Festus. So, let's see, in Acts 21, you get Paul arrested, then he's before the Sanhedrin.
Yes.
Then he goes before Felix, then Festus, then Agrippa.
All right, let's name the chapters. We've got him arrested in 21.
Sanhedrin in 22. Festus.
No, we got it wrong. We've got him arrested in 21, and then in 22, it's before the Jewish people in Jerusalem, as he's on the courts of the stairs. Yeah, okay, now go.
Then we have Sanhedrin in 23.
Yes.
Then 24 is going to be Felix.
Yes.
And in 25, we've got Festus, and now he's going to be in front of Agrippa.
All right, in 26. Yeah, very good, very good. And we need to be able to do that for obvious reasons, to know what's happening to Paul in Jerusalem and the events transpiring. Now, in our study this morning, I went back and listened to your discussion Wednesday night about some characters that I had asked you to do some research on, to learn a little bit about Felix and Drusilla, his wife, and to learn a little bit about Festus and even Agrippa and Bernice. And you did that, and I'm pleased with the outcome of that. But just as a general question, we'll talk more about Agrippa and Bernice as we get to that in a little bit. But Felix, when the Apostle Paul reasoned with him about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, the text tells us in verse 25 that Felix was terrified. Why? Exactly, yes. What kind of character was Felix, and for that matter, Drusilla? Can you tell me anything about their character?
Probably not the most honorable people.
Not the most honorable people, no, no. In fact, we know that they were immoral. We know that they were in an unlawful marriage. We know that Felix would accept bribes, and that's why he kept Paul in prison. He desired to receive money from the disciples. And then for Paul to reason with Felix about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, he's hitting right at the heart of things that Felix himself is involved with. And it tells us that he was indeed terrified. Now, in the last verse of chapter 24, we noted that after 2 years, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to gain favor with the Jews, Felix left Paul in bonds. Now, I don't know if you talked a little bit. I didn't listen all the way to the end, but almost, of the class. Did you talk about Felix and his no longer serving as governor and Festus then becoming governor. Did you talk a little bit about why Felix ceased to be governor? I'll take that as a no, okay? Well, you may want to do a little research on that. There's some implications that Felix engaged in some kind of judiciary misconduct that caused him to lose the position as governor. Not just that this was term limits, but his term was limited because of the conduct that he had exercised while he was there. But be that as it may, to our point, in chapter 25, we notice that Festus, therefore, having come to or into the province after 3 days, went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. Why did he go to Jerusalem? What's his job, and what was Felix's job? Johnny? Yes, and primarily their responsibility was to do what?
Keep the peace.
Keep the peace, yes. Here are Roman officials, and their job essentially was to keep the peace in this province. And so Festus comes to Jerusalem. Why do you suppose he would come to Jerusalem? What's going on among the Jews?
This whole guy Paul is messing things up.
It's all messed up, yes. So he goes to Jerusalem, and while he's there, he learns about some things with which Paul is charged. In verse 7, it tells us that when he was come, the Jews that had come down from Jerusalem stood round about him, bringing against him many and grievous charges, which they could not prove. While Paul said in his defense, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I sinned at all. But Festus, desiring to gain favor with the Jews, answered Paul and said, wilt thou go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me? Now these Roman governors, we've said that their primary objective was to keep peace among the Jews. How do you do that?
Give them what they want.
Give them what they want, yes. And in this particular instance, Festus has learned in Jerusalem that Paul doesn't have a very good reputation. And so they want to kill Paul. Now Festus is very happy to make that come to pass. As he suggests to Paul after he returns to Caesarea, why don't you go up to Jerusalem and be judged about these matters? Well, why was Paul in Caesarea to begin with and not in Jerusalem? Jews wanted to kill him. And we've talked about how that Claudius Lysias helped Paul get out of town, if you please, over to Caesarea, taking 470 soldiers to remove him from Jerusalem and to take him over to Caesarea. Now, Paul, in verse 10, responds to that and said, I am standing before Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as thou also very well knowest. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if none of those things is true whereof these accuse me, no man can give me up to them. I appeal unto Caesar. Now there are several things in here that are noteworthy. One is, we note that Paul says, if I've done anything wrong, then I'm not adverse to suffering the consequences. I'll do that. Even unto death. Now what does that tell us about Paul's attitude about corporal punishment? Capital punishment, yes. Capital punishment. No objection to die. That's right. Now, one of the things I want us to note here is, much like the thief on the cross. Now, we'll say this and then we'll move on because it's just a touch and go point. But when we talk about the thief on the cross, when Jesus forgave the thief on the cross, did that mean then that he wasn't to be executed because he was a criminal? No. Forgiveness is not the same thing as freedom from temporal consequences. And we've talked about that a number of times. This is a passage, I believe, that can very well be used to substantiate that. Paul, in times gone by, indeed had lived a life in good conscience, believing that putting people to death was the thing that he ought to do. But even so here, he says, if I've done anything worthy of death, if that's what the law requires, then I refuse not to die. But, he said, if I have not done any of those things, and they cannot be substantiated against me, then no man has the right to deliver me to the Jews. Paul said, I stand before Caesar's judgment seat. Why was Felix and why was Festus given the position of governorship to begin with? Well, we say to keep peace among the Jews. But does that mean that they have the right to ignore Roman law in order to do that? I can't do that, no. Roman law has designated these men to sit in judgment. So when he says, I am before Caesar's judgment seat, we know that he's not in front of Caesar, but he's in front of the authority that Caesar has appointed to be judge in this case. Yes. That's right. That's right. Now, that's one interesting thing we're going to note about Roman law. They could keep a man incarcerated for a period of time without charges being substantiated. Now, we wouldn't like that, would we? But that was Roman law. Didn't have to charge you. Just keep you in jail because you've been accused. That's exactly right. Now, there were limitations on what they could do to him. But they could keep him in prison for a period of time without ever charging him with anything. Yeah. Now, that's what's taking place here in Acts chapter 25 and these next few chapters. Festus now, he has a problem. Paul, a Roman citizen, has made his appeal to Caesar, which he has the right to do. And then it says in verse 12, then Festus, when he conferred with the council, answered, thou hast appealed unto Caesar thou shalt go. But he's got a problem. In verse 13, in fact, through the remainder of this chapter, what's his problem?
He doesn't know what to put on the charge.
Yes, what are we going to put in writing when we send him before Caesar? So Agrippa, the king, and Bernice arrive at Caesarea and saluted Festus. And as he tarried there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there is a certain man left in prison, or left a prisoner by Felix, about whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me, asking for sentence against him. To whom I answered that it is not the custom of the Romans to give up any man before that the accused have the accusers face to face and have had opportunity to make his defense concerning the matter laid against him. Now that raises some flags, and I'm sure you see that when Festus has asked Paul to go to Jerusalem and there be judged about these matters. Well, what does Festus suspect, and obviously so, is going to happen based upon the history of this case if he moves him from Caesarea to Jerusalem? Well, the probability is he's going to be killed. Now, why would Festus do that?
That means he's no longer in trouble.
Yeah, he solved the problem, you see. Indeed, perhaps a murder has taken place, but the problem existing among the Jews, we've suppressed that. Now, if you'll keep reading in this text, when he says, to whom I answer, verse 16, that it's not the custom of the Jews to give up any man before the accused, to have the accusers face to face. Well, you know, on paper that looks good, don't it? But in practicality, if he can get Paul to move from Caesarea to Jerusalem to meet these accusers face to face, then the probability of his safe arrival might be questioned. In verse 17, he said, when therefore they were come together here, I made no delay, but on the next day sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought. concerning whom, when the accuser stood up, they brought no charge of such evil things as I suppose, but had certain questions against him of their own religion and of one Jesus, whom was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. And I, being perplexed how to inquire concerning these things, asked whether he would go to Jerusalem and there be judged of these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be kept for the decision of the emperor, I commanded him to be kept till I should send him to Caesar. And Agrippa said unto Festus, I also would wish to hear the man myself tomorrow, saith he, thou shalt hear him. Well, now, again, you've identified the problem. He's got a prisoner and he don't know what to charge him with. So Herod the king is going to help him to formulate some kind of charges that he can write down and send to Caesar. Now, if you would, John, are you able to read there for me? Verses 23 through verse 27 of Acts chapter 25. And we'll see what Agrippa and Bernice, or Bernice, as the emphasis there seems to be on the second syllable. But when we read about Agrippa and Bernice coming before Paul, or Paul coming before them, I should say, how does that transpire, John? That would be unfair, wouldn't it? Alright. So, King Agrippa and Bernice, you talked a little bit in the class Wednesday about these two and the relationship that they had to each other. This is interesting. I want to pass beyond this chart to this one. Richard, I know in the study Wednesday said that there were, and I'm not quoting you exactly, but there were a whole lot of Agrippas. And that's true. When we look at the Herodian family, we see that indeed there are a lot of Agrippas. Here is Herod the Great, and of course we want to identify him. You said, I think, that there are a whole lot of Agrippas, but you also said there are a whole lot of Herods. Herod the Great, who is at the peak of this family tree, as we have it labeled here, Herod the Great was the one who was reigning when Jesus was born. And he was the one that ordered where do I have it on this chart?
On the right hand side, right up the top of the circle.
There it is. Killed the babies in Bethlehem. I knew it was up there. He killed the babies in Bethlehem because he had heard that there was another king. He also ordered that his nephews over here be killed, and they were executed. Now here you see the development of the family tree even further. Here we have Herod Philip, who was disinherited. We know that he was married to Herodias in Matthew chapter 14 and Mark chapter 6, whom John said, it's not lawful for you to have her. And then what happened to John?
He died suddenly.
All right, here's Herod Antipas over here, and this arrow, if you'll follow it, we know that this Herod over here had married this Herod's wife, and so it's this Herod that ordered that John the Baptist be killed, and so forth. It's this Herod that heard the trial of Jesus, and if you can read my writing over here, that explains who he is. Now we have another Herod over here that not much is said about him in the Scriptures. He's referred to in Luke chapter 3, verse 1, as simply Herod the Tetrarch. We don't know too much more about him. But if we follow the family tree on this side, we've got Herod Agrippa the First. Now, Herod Agrippa the First is the fellow you're reading about in Acts chapter... Acts chapter 12. Thank you. Acts chapter 12, who had James beheaded and kept Peter in prison, hoping to do the same thing to please the Jews. Acts chapter 12, there it is on the chart. Acts chapter 12. And then, of course, we come down here and you talked about Herod Agrippa the second, who was married to Drusilla. I'm sorry, Herod Agrippa the second, who heard Paul's defense. I'll get that right in Acts 25 and 26. Here we have Drusilla, and I want you to see the relationship between Drusilla and Agrippa the first. Brother and sister, you see that? And here Drusilla was married to Felix. Now, when you talk about Herod Agrippa the second, who heard Paul's defense, he was not a very nice guy either. When you read about Bernice, I was talking with Richard yesterday. I used to think when I was much younger that Bernice and Herod the second were a man and wife. You got king and queen, and that's not the case at all. Who was Bernice in relation to Agrippa? Sister. That's right, his sister. Now, it might be noteworthy just here to know that Bernice had been married before and for some reason divorced. She had been then came home to her brother's house, Agrippa, and then she became a mistress of another man. And that evidently didn't work out, and she came back to her brother's house. And as Richard and I both had read, there were rumors that there was a whole lot more than just brother-sister relationship between these two folks. So what I want you to see is this person that Paul is standing before is not a very reputable person. Now, one of the things that I want to note just here, going back to this chart, is when you look at this family tree, some, I believe, come to an incorrect conclusion in verse 2, where Paul is making his defense before Agrippa, verse 2 of chapter 26. Paul said, "I think myself happy, King Agrippa, that I am to make my defense before thee this day, touching all the things whereof I am accused by the Jews, especially because thou art expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews, where for I beseech thee to hear me patiently." Some come to the conclusion from reading that passage that this lineage of the Herods and so forth, that we're talking about folks who were Jews. And I know why, at least I think I do, why that argument is made. When you read about Herod Philip and Herod Antipas and Herodias, folks say, well, they were Jews, and so whatever John was saying about their marriage relationship being unlawful, it was unlawful because the law of Moses said you can't do that, so it's incest, and incest was prohibited by the law of Moses. Now, that sounds real good on the surface, except when you trace their history back, they were not Jewish. When you trace their history back, the Herodian family, what were they? Idumean, which means from the Edomites. That's right. Now, even though when we get down to Herod Philip and Herod Antipas, yes, we find Herod Agrippa the second down here. Yes, he has adopted, in some respects, the Jews' religion, but that does not make him Jewish.
I think, as I recall, when we were studying back in the Maccabees times and things like that, that at that time or sometime later, the Jews had conquered the Idumeans.
Yes.
And they were under their rule or jurisdiction or something like that. And so a lot of people said, well, in order for them to get along with the Jews, a lot of them sort of converted, but it was just sort of a nominal conversion. I mean, it's not that they were observant Jews type thing.
Well, yes, and when we look at the character of the Herodian family, I want us to see clearly that when John said it's not lawful for you to have her, John is not saying that it's not lawful for you to have her according to the law of Moses. Because though these folks may have down through the generations somewhat adopted some of the customs of the Jews, they sure did not practice it because they were not Jews. And understanding then John's statement, it's not lawful for you to have her, your brother Philip's wife. It's not just a matter of incest. You know, when I study this and study it with others, I like to ask the question, would it be all right if Herod had your wife? Not his brother's wife, but your wife. Would that make it fine? Well, now you know better than that. So John is not saying it's not lawful according to the law of Moses because Moses prohibited incest. God's law generally governed the marriage relationship. And whatever Herod and Herodias are doing over here, it's contrary to God's law, period. Not specifically the law of Moses. Now, if we get a handle on that and see that clearly, then we see the relationship that Herod and Herodias have and why John said that's not lawful and what you've got to do to resolve that. Now, that's why I threw that in. Yes, Joey?
Like you pointed out many times in the past, everybody has always been under law.
Exactly.
It may not be the law of Moses, but you're under law. And everybody throughout time has been under God's law. None of those various laws have ever permitted, incest, adultery, these types of things.
That's right.
So it doesn't matter which law you're under. Those are clearly forbidden under every variation of law that God has ever imposed upon man.
Well, that's right. Of course, you see the reason that this is argued. Well, it was the law of Moses, and Moses prohibited incest. Well, again, if it was your wife, would that make it lawful and not somebody in the family? Well, no. Why? Because God legislated that from Genesis 2. Not just incest in the law of Moses, you see. So I think that's something that we need to ponder while we're here. Now, when we talk about Agrippa II, this man that's sitting in judgment of Paul, or hearing Paul's case, we know that he was given the northeastern section of this province. And when Paul went to Caesarea to appear before Felix and Festus, these were the governors, and now, of course, King Agrippa is there to help Festus to decide what to write on the paper, to charge him with. Now, Paul is describing Agrippa, as we noticed, as being expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews. Now, that obviously is true. But does that make Herod Agrippa II a practicing Jew?
No. The section that we read from Josephus on Wednesday, talking about the fact that Herod built this whatever thing on his palace, his living room or whatever, that overlooked directly the temple. And the Jews were really upset about that he was looking into the temple. Number one indicates that Herod was familiar with them because he lived in Jerusalem, in the palace in Jerusalem. And number two, they were upset because he, a non-Jew, was looking into the temple. And so they erected this wall so he couldn't see anymore.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Very interesting. I have underlined outwardly. The Herod family outwardly observed the law, but superficially you can see that in the lives, of course, that they lived. Now, coming back to Acts chapter 26, when we note that Paul said, "You're expert in all the customs and manner and so forth of the Jews," why did Paul recognize that as some kind of an advantage? What?
The same reason that he went to every synagogue that he ever preached, that every time that he went to the synagogue first, because they had already had a history and knew what the scriptures said.
All right.
So he could sit there and say, the scriptures have been fulfilled.
That's right. Exactly right. Now let's carry that to the next level in this text with what he says. He calls upon Agrippa to hear me patiently. Now verse 4. My manner of life then, from my youth up, which was from the beginning among mine own nation, and at Jerusalem know all the Jews, having knowledge of me from the first, if they be willing to testify, that after the straitest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. Now, why is that so relevant? Here you've got these folks, Paul said, they've known me since I was a baby. Now, where was Paul born?
Tarsus.
That's right. He's born in Tarsus. But where was he raised? In Jerusalem. Who schooled him?
Gamaliel.
And he says here that he was brought up after the straitest sect of our religion, a Pharisee. Now, what did the Jews, and in particular the Pharisees, what were they looking for? What were they expecting to come?
A physical kingdom.
Yes. And they were interpreting these Old Testament prophecies of the coming of the Messiah to be a prophecy of a coming earthly king that would deliver them from under the thumb of the Romans. Now, the thing that I find interesting about that is Paul said, these folks know me. They know what I've believed in the past. They know the extent to which I have believed that. To the extent that folks who did not pursue that, I wanted to kill them and did. Now, the significance further of that, in verse 6, one, you've got it nailed. It says, and now I stand here to be judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers, unto which promise our 12 tribes, earnestly serving God night and day, hope to attain. And concerning this hope, I am accused by the Jews, O King. What I want you to see in these verses is that the Apostle Paul recognizes that there is a hope that the Jews held on to. What was it? The coming of the Messiah. Yes. Why was that so important to them? Now this is crucial. What was the Messiah going to do for them? Deliver them from the Romans. Their perception was not that the Messiah is going to come and deliver us from sin. The hope of Israel, as it were, was deliverance from the Romans. Now Paul said, concerning the hope of Israel, I am called in question. Now I want us to see that the hope of Israel was not deliverance from the Romans. The hope of Israel was deliverance from sin. Now Paul had not understood that in times gone by, but he's got it now. Now when you begin to read and study about the fulfillment of the promise, the hope of Israel, you can trace that thing all the way back to Genesis 3:15. And we note that it was repeated to Abraham in Genesis 12, Genesis 22, and all these Old Testament texts that talk about the coming of the Messiah, how that He would deliver from sin. Now, a familiarity from our standpoint, looking back, it makes you raise the question, well, how could anybody miss that? Paul had. And I think it's significant just here to let the point sink in very well that Paul knows exactly, just exactly, why he's here making his defense before Agrippa. Because he knows just exactly how these Jews, who've known him all his life, are thinking.
Just made me think, and I think Joey said this last Wednesday, is that this shows, again, the providence of God, of Him placing a Roman citizen in this position. In other words, if he'd been just a Jew that wasn't a Roman citizen, he wouldn't have gotten this far.
Oh, no.
He wouldn't have been able to talk to these, preach to these people. They'd have just killed him in Jerusalem, and nobody would have cared about it one way or the other. But as was mentioned, you know, God knew what He was doing in putting this man, who is not only a Jew but a Roman citizen, in this position.
Well, that's right. And of course, when we read of the words of the Lord to Ananias, back over in Acts chapter 9, as Saul of Tarsus had seen the light on the road and saw the Lord, and the Lord has identified Himself to him. We know that he went into the city of Damascus. He was miserable, didn't eat or drink for 3 days. And the Lord said to Ananias to go and teach Saul. In verse 15 of chapter 9, it says, but the Lord said unto him, go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me, to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. To bear my name before kings. Now we know he's appeared before two Roman governors, and now who is he in front of? King Agrippa. Who's he going to be in front of? King Caesar, the Emperor of Rome. Now, that's very significant. And why is he going? Because he's been preaching the hope of Israel, which for years the nation of Israel has misunderstood, and I must say that even today most folks have misunderstood the hope of Israel, believing that it was to be some kind of temporal kingdom. There are folks today who are looking forward to some kind of a temporal kingdom. Paul says that's just not so. That was never a part of the promise. And Paul said, I stand here to be judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers. See, that had nothing to do with delivering them as some kind of a mighty nation to come out of from under the thumb of Rome. That was never a part of the promise. But remission of sins was. And when Peter preached that initially in Acts chapter 2, calling upon those Jews to believe that God had raised him from the dead, and they asked, what shall we do? He said, for to you is the promise. You see, the hope of Israel was fulfilled in the providing of remission of sins, not in their freedom from Roman oppression. So Ron, Juan, you got that nailed. Exactly right. He's telling King Agrippa these things because King Agrippa is familiar with this way of thinking. He's familiar with the customs and the practices and the teaching of the Jews. That doesn't mean he's endorsed it or adopted it. So Paul makes his defense before King Agrippa. Now, interestingly enough, in Acts chapter 26, as you continue down through this text, Paul is telling King Agrippa the kind of life that he's lived in the past and why he did that. In verse 8, as we continue the thought there, he says, why is it judged incredible with you if God doth raise the dead? Now, that's an interesting question. King Agrippa, why do you think that's so far outside the circle? To think that God raised the dead. Why would Paul ask Agrippa that? Silence. Yes.
Well, this has always puzzled me. It just seems like it's just thrown in there right in the middle of something, and then we go on to something else later. But when Festus was explaining the charges, as it were, that were made by the Jews, he said that Paul's, they're talking about this guy Jesus who was killed, but Paul says he's alive. And so that appears to be one of the points that's being discussed here. And so Agrippa, though, knowing about the Jewish traditions and laws and things like that, would know also what went on in Jerusalem at that time, at the time of Jesus' death, and the rumors, as it were, of this man being raised from the dead.
Now, this is not new, is it?
No.
No. It ought not be the first time you've heard this, Agrippa, that here's a man that was raised from the dead. And when you look at the history of the Herodian family tree, you see folks that have a background in idolatry to begin with. So why would this be such an incredible thing to you to hear a message like this? You know, it doesn't make any difference to you one way or the other as far as that is concerned. We see later that I think there are some implications that it does. But Paul explains that I did what I thought I ought to do. Now, if you're not familiar with Acts 26, verse 9, you need to memorize that thing. Paul said, this is what I did, and this is why I did it. I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And this I also did in Jerusalem. And I both shut up many of the saints in prisons, and having received authority from the chief priest, and when they were put to death, I gave my vote against them, and punishing them oftentimes in the synagogues, or all the synagogues, I strove to make them blaspheme, and being exceedingly mad against them, I persecuted them, even unto foreign cities. And then he begins to explain that's why I was going to Damascus. Now, James, when Paul said that I thought that this was what I ought to do, what does that tell us about Paul?
He was zealous, and he was sincere, and he was dedicated.
All right, exactly. Now, he's already expressed that. Where and to whom? I have lived before God in all good conscience until this day. Acts 23. All right, in Acts 23, now who are we talking to? The Sanhedrin. That's right. Very good. So he's telling this Jewish court, I've been sincere in this. And that's been his stance all the way through. And that's what he says to King Agrippa. Here's what I did, and these folks know it. You see, these Jews that are here, they know what I did if they'd be willing to testify. You're right. When you talk about pointed statements made, when we go all the way back to Acts 2, 3, 4, 5, and so forth, we see some very pointed statements made. Those who had the authority over the apostles to execute them, when we talk about the Jewish court and so forth, when you look in Acts chapter, where is it? Acts chapter 5. Well, you can go back to Acts chapter 4 and pick it up if you'd like to. In Acts chapter 4, in verse 12 and following, just call your attention to this. Peter and John have appeared before the court, and they're being asked about the healing of this man that was lame. And he instructs them that in the name of Jesus of Nazareth, we commanded him to be whole. And then he said in verse 13, you denied him before the face of Pilate when he had determined to release him. You denied the holy and righteous one and asked for a murderer to be granted unto you and killed the Prince of Life whom God raised from the dead, and we're witnesses. You talk about pointed statements. And then you see exactly the same thing in the fourth chapter there beginning about verse 8. As he again looks upon this court and he calls them rulers of the people and so forth. And he tells them exactly the same thing. And then you've got the same thing in chapter 4 beginning in verse 18 and following. And then in Acts chapter 5 beginning in verse 28, you've got the same thing. He says, we strictly charged you not to teach in this name, and behold, you fill Jerusalem with your teaching and intend to bring this man's blood upon us. But Peter said, and the apostles answered and said, we must obey God rather than men, the God of our fathers that raised up Jesus, whom ye slew, hanging him on a tree. And then the sermon of Stephen, who? You talk about pointed. Now, in all of these instances, what's being preached? Even when we include what Paul preached, what he had so formerly, as Saul of Tarsus, denied, what is he now preaching? The hope of Israel, which entails the resurrection of Jesus. That's what he's preaching. Now, before, he said, this is what I thought I ought to do, but I've learned better. That'd be hard to argue with, as the Lord said, hard to kick against the goads, when here it is, the resurrected Lord, standing before you saying, go to Damascus. Randy and then Joey. He had his hand up first. Sorry, I'd about forgotten him.
I was just going to point out there in Acts 23:11, on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to me in my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness in Rome also. Well, this is the same Lord that appeared to him on the road to Damascus. Mm-hmm. And that gave him new boldness.
Yeah.
For the rest of the book of Acts, he knows, I'm not going to die before I get to Rome.
Oh, that's right.
I'm going to Rome.
I'm going to Rome. And Paul, of course, Paul indicated that in a number of his writings. But your point, I think, is interesting, not only from the standpoint that the Lord appeared to him. We know that the Lord appeared to Saul of Tarsus, I believe, on three different occasions. One on the road to Damascus, one is here, and then I'm failing to remember the third one, but there were three occasions. Now, in our study, going back to Acts chapter 26, I'm sorry, Joey, thanks for reminding me.
Just a quick question.
the reference you have up there, you almost persuade me to be a Christian. I'm holding here the New American Standard. It's actually called the Updated New American Standard. And it's phrased this way. Agrippa replied to Paul, "In a short time, you will persuade me to become a Christian." So this particular New American Standard doesn't have the word almost there.
Yeah.
It has kind of a different, you know, flavor.
A little different flavor, yes. So, I want to talk about that.
So my question really, and maybe Richard has an interlinear handy, I don't know, but in the original Greek, is the word almost there, or is it necessarily applied? Or?
It indicates little, small amount. Now, the thing that I find interesting when you look at, well, some commentators and some historical views of this passage, some took the position that what Agrippa is saying is, do you think you'll make me a Christian with just a little persuasion?
Well, he hasn't phrased it as a question. I mean, it here says, in a short time, you will persuade me. So, My point is, in a short time, conceptually, it has a really different meaning than the word almost.
Yeah.
I'm wondering which is more accurate.
Well, now I can't tell you the answer to that. But what I do know is that some look at this two different ways. Do you think that with just a little bit of preaching, you'll make me a Christian? Or the statement that Agrippa's almost, that he's just almost there, just needs a little nudge to go over the line, and he'll be a Christian. And either way you go on that, there are some conclusions, I think, that come out the same. Richard?
The phrase en oligos in the Greek, the definition of the word oligos, it's of uncertain affinity, it says. It says, puny in extent, degree, number, duration, or value, especially neuter, somewhat. And then in the King James, it's translated almost, briefly, few, a little, long, or plus long. And a season, short, small, wide.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of it's a generic kind of word that translates.
So it's really hard to know exactly what the meaning there.
Yeah.
It's hard to know if the word almost is more accurately, you know, conveying the idea, or like it says here, in a short time.
Paul's response to that helps us to understand the statement. Look at Paul's response to what he has said. In verse 29, Paul said, I would to God that whether with little, there's your thought, or with much,
short time, yes.
Not thou only, but also all that hear me this day might become such as I am, except these bonds. Now, the distinction between whether he's saying, well, I'm almost there, you just almost convinced me, or do you think that with just a little persuasion, you'll make me a Christian? Yeah, who do you think you are kind of thing.
Yeah.
That becomes irrelevant. Because here we read of a man who has had evidence presented to him. We know that's so because Paul said, believest thou the prophets? I know thou believest.
Right.
So this had been presented to King Agrippa. It was not new material.
I don't get the impression here that he's mocking Paul or saying something like, who do you think you are just to think you could convince me? I don't get that impression based upon the back and forth there.
Perhaps so. But the point is, Paul's desire is that he might be persuaded, whether it takes a whole lot of persuasion or a little bit. The conclusion is that you might be persuaded. Carolyn and then Richard.
Point of clarification, something you said a moment ago. You said Christ appeared to Paul three times. Did you mean he appeared once and he told about it three times?
No. And the text of Acts chapter 9, if you'll note in verse
Acts
chapter 9. Let me read just a little bit more.
In Acts chapter 18, verse 9, the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision.
Okay, that's the third time.
Do not be afraid of the Lord, go on speaking.
That's the third time. He appeared to him on the road to Damascus. He appeared to him in the text that you're referring to. And he appeared to him in Acts 26. 23, I'm sorry. Acts 23. So there were three times. It was the Acts 18 reference that I couldn't remember. So he appeared to him three times. Now, there's a passage, and I thought it was Acts 9, where when the Lord is speaking to Ananias, it's probably not in Acts 9. At least I didn't see it in a brief scan of the verses. The Lord said to Ananias, I will... here it is, verse 16 of chapter 26. I knew it was somewhere. As Paul is relating the words, he said, But arise and stand upon thy feet, for to this end have I appeared unto thee, to appoint thee a minister and a witness both of the things wherein thou hast seen me and of the things wherein I will appear unto thee. Now the point on the timeline was on his way to Damascus. But the Lord said, I will appear. And he did two more times.